Mars, and when it's in high noon sunlight, it's very bright. So you got the spacecraft and the bright reflections off of the dirt of the moon, the dust of the moon, regolith, I guess it's called. And therefore, I believe your eyes see the blackest possible star, sky, and I think you don't see the stars when you're on the moon. When the photographs are taken of the spacecraft on the moon, done by the astronauts, the fact that the stars are not showing in the background has caused some people to say that the pictures were faked. I think the people making that pronouncement don't realize how dim a star is, how dark adapted your eyes have to be in order to really see a star clearly at nighttime. And they were in high noon sunlight. Is that about the way you see it, Paul? Pun intended. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, they see the black sky. Now, I've heard some guys say that some stories that they do see the stars. You know, you don't have the air like you have on the Earth. It's all being scattered. So that's why we can't see, you know, that's why we see a blue sky. We don't see a black sky. They see a black sky. But if they look away from the sun, I believe they can see the stars. You know, all kinds of reflections, I guess, off the helmets. Yeah, he saw all darkness. It was a big difference between the two astronauts standing there looking at the same thing. But, very good. And then there were, a total of six landings, so you had 10 guys after that. And each one had their own remarks. Dean, he said there might be one big, not Dean, Conrad, the commander for the Apollo 12, he said it might be one small step for Neil Armstrong, but it's one big step for him. He was a little guy, so he was joking when he got off the ladder.
That's a good sense of humor. The actual guy standing on the moon took place on Apollo 11, 12, 13, no, because of the failure in space of the oxygen bottle. So Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, 17. So six total landings, 12 guys walked on the moon. And so when Buzz Aldrin was saying a magnificent desolation, he's looking at... Mile diameter asteroid. Wow. what's the approximate diameter of Sirius, which is going to go around in orbit around it later on? Back to you, Paul. And Sirius is 1/300, 1/600 miles in diameter. Which is which, Paul?
Is the smaller of the two. Now it will go on to Sirius, arrive there. It's going to take a couple of years, probably 2.5 years to get there, 3 years. 2000.
They use the ion engine to do some of the propulsion out to Sirius. But when they actually went into orbit around Sirius, did that require a chemical engine to make that particular blast? Over to you, Paul.
And it takes off. Exactly the same as going into orbit. It's, you know, a reverse process. It just, you know, keep the engine on, facing in a certain direction. You know, they do have thrusters on board, hydrazine thrusters to, you know, orient this thing in space.
Numbers down to 6 watts or so. now that Dawn is in orbit around Vista and taking some beautiful pictures, what's your guess as to the orbital altitude? Is it 300 miles above Vista, so to speak? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, it starts off, of course, tremendously. I mean, it's like a 10-to-1 ratio for apogee and perigee. But I think eventually it gets down to the 150-200-mile range. Going around irregular bodies, you know, it's not a complete sphere. They're doing pretty good with this kind of thing. They did it with the Near spacecraft when that landed on Eros. That was an asteroid that they landed on. To orbit this thing and do what they're doing, they've really come a long way. I mean, they used to launch rockets to the moon, and they used to miss the moon. They're trying to hit the moon, and they couldn't do it.
Yeah, both the Soviets and the United States were having that problem, and that's because we hadn't yet invented the idea of a mid-course correction procedure. You can aim a rocket toward the moon as accurate as you like, but you're always going to miss a little bit. But once you've launched and you do some very accurate navigation, you find out where it is, what direction it's going. It's nowhere near as difficult to find out what is the error, and then at one, two, or three places along the mission, you decide that if I do a mid-course correction, a couple of seconds of blast in the right direction, now you've really refined the accuracy of the original launch. So I think that explains that. Good stuff. Boy, lots of spacecraft going out there, Paul. A lot of good things to look forward to. One last question. I know that there was this very large magnet on the gamma ray detector, very high power gamma ray detector, that was brought up to the International Space Station installed. Alpha magnetic resonance imaging? No. Was that the Alpha project? I've forgotten the name of the project, and have we heard any feedback yet as to the kind of data it's gathering? WS2N, K2RIW?
I know it's up and running. I haven't seen any results as of yet. So sometimes the results is dated, you know. You have to watch that, you know. You look up some of the information on these spacecraft, and, you know, the last science report, for instance, for Dawn was probably 6 months ago. Same will probably hold true for that. Basically, it's a telescope mounted onto the International Space Station. I'm sure will yield plenty of results. That they don't need cryogenics. It's on there forever. That's nice. Years ago, you know, you put this thing into orbit, it would need cryogenics. It would last two or three years, and that would be it. Here, it's on the space station. You don't need the cryogenics. They've come a long way with that. And I haven't seen any piece of equipment yet. But we'll see. Back to you.
Question for Paul.
Go ahead, John.
Paul, what do you think the chances, or have you read anything about another trip to Hubble, or are they just going to let that thing wind down and come down here? Do you think there's any chance of making one more try?
No, there's no chance. That's it. The shuttle system's gone. So if they get 5 more years out of that, they'll be happy, John. So much for that.
Thank you.
Gyros. You're saying there's only four gyros? Go ahead.
you looked at the mirror, pictures of the mirror, all the tubing, piping.
International Space Station a lot larger than the gyros on the Hubble Space Telescope? Back to you, Paul.
There's momentum gyroscopes and there's real gyroscopes. The momentum thing actually keep it oriented. They're pretty big. Gyroscopes themselves, the new one, when it was built for the Hubble, those things, the ones that actually they used for orientation, was old. Now they have all these new ones. That's what they have on board the space station, though, so they're a lot smaller and lighter on the space station.
The space station, International Space Station, is so massive. I'm amazed that they could use smaller gyros. These gyros, I think, are a very heavy rotating mass, probably with a magnetic bearing, so that when it's running, nothing touches. And therefore, their wear-out procedure is a little bit mysterious to me. What in the world is the failure mechanism if nothing is touching? Back to you, Paul.
We went through this with the gyros that are on board James Webb Space Telescope. Similar types of things are on board the space station. They're called hemispherical resonated gyros. They're small things, you know. It's like small than a soccer ball, you know. It's got this high vacuum enclosure on top, and they got these electrodes below that, and hemispherical resonators below that. Some kind of pickups below that, and it's all like sandwiched together, and then they pick up all the information from that, and they're very, very small and highly reliable. No spinning anything on board these things, so they're very, very good, and that's what they're going to have on the space telescope, and I believe they also have them, of course, on the space station.
You said gyro, and you said nothing is spinning, so I'm now a little bit confused. I could have a XYZ sensing device that maybe, it's vibrating reeds or whatever, no real gyro. But don't the gyros rotate like a gyroscope? How would you call?
No, they don't. It's some kind of resonating. Pick it up. Put it on.
play around.
So you rang this wine glass, put it on a turntable of a record player, and then spun the record player turntable real fast while it was in the freewheeling mode. Is that what you're saying, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, oh yeah. And then turned it on, put it on the slowest speed I could find, you know. And the thing wanted to fly off, you know. If I didn't want to ruin this turntable, I would have glued it to it, but that didn't work. But if I turn it by hand, you know, you don't have to turn it that fast. You can.
Hydrazine rockets to unload the amount of accumulated momentum on the momentum gyros on the Hubble Space Telescope. Over to you, Paul.
Don't know. Not sure. I missed the question. I thought I'd listen to the repeater instead of the input sticks. I kind of missed that one again. Not problems. All right. Very good. Back to you, Dan.
Yeah. What I'm asking is, do they do unloading of the momentum that gets accumulated in the momentum gyros on the International Space Station? Depending on how the solar wind hits it or whatever, and you try to force it to stay in a particular orientation by using your momentum wheels, but if eventually your momentum wheels are going to be spun up to the maximum speed to unload them, don't you have to use the hydrazine rockets at that time, WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, well, I would, anytime they get into a problem where you can't, you want to reverse the effect of, you have other gyros, other momentum gyros that to compensate for it. They have that, that problem was solved years ago with that was a big problem, gimbal lock with gyros. I remember reading about that. Some guys did solve these problems. They could using a third gyro, third one in, instead of just using two, but your different orientation. But I think since then, the newer ones, after Apollo 13, they don't worry about it as much. I believe there's a third, there's always a third gyro involved, and somehow that's hooked up to it. I don't know enough about it, but I know it's not a problem anymore.
Very fine, Paul. Thank you for all that information about all those spacecraft. Wes, I know I'm going to be able to hear you on the input. The most recent email you mailed me, Wes, not only has the two white diagrams, but it also has a YouTube video, which is in a foreign language, which shows a man using a clamp-on ammeter. And at first he's using a clamp-on ammeter, I guess, on an input wire, and he shows very little current, and then there's about 10 individual other wires, which I presume are output wires, and then he, one after the other, puts the clamp-on ammeter on the output wires, and I guess he's showing the greater output current than input current. Is that true, Wes? WS2N, K2RIW?
Anthony Shane, yes. The current drone was 0.2, 0.7 ampere, and the power output was about 100 kilowatts. This is one of the materials that has never been published, and this year we have four of them, if I remember correctly. Each one is incredibly interesting, and was not available today. It looks like some folks decided that they want to release that information, and they were witnessing that. Let me jump. Okay, I'm going to continue further. So, you have a structure of three coils, which is a black coil, and you have a structure of three bigger coils. Very much similar structure to the one that was shown in Turkey on the glass table. But, apart from that, you have another coil that is completely exposed, showing a typical structure of the Tesla coil with the big capacitor on the top of it that looks like a big balloon or big bolt or sphere. My assumption is that that one was not connected and didn't take a part of that. It was just for a show. But evidently, this device did not have a Samosa Pitka, which is self-looping, the excess of energy to the input, and the guy is still operating. And at that point, there was a little bit doubt about any trick that was done over there. Sometime after that, there was a presentation with the scientists and this big antenna and the spectrum analyzer on the glass table. That one was in Turkey and did not... Actually, both of them were in Turkey, but that one on the glass table that I don't have this video on it right now, that one was not using the additional coil. So we're talking about three phases, three interior coils, three pickup coils, the bigger coils, and additional coil with the big sphere on the top of it that I believe didn't have anything to do with it. It was just for a show, but two.
I'm hearing everything you said on the input system to where the clamp on ammeter was measuring input current and output current. We didn't know what voltage was coming out, but I presume he was left. I didn't get a chance to see the end of the video, so we didn't have to worry about the output voltage because it was, in theory, a lighting up of light bulbs, probably 220-volt light bulbs. Is that true, Wes?
Correct. And all of the loads connected, 40 kilowatts of the motors that was connected, plus all of the lamps, it was approximately each 1 kilowatt. They were approximately about 100 kilowatts of total load.
Loaded 40 horsepower motor.
I saw the motor, and I presume the motor was turning its fan, but it had no load on it at that time. Is that true, John?
That's correct, Dick. It's marked 40 horsepower. The shaft appears to be rotating, but there is no load on it. It's just spinning free. So, another question, Dick. With a single input, no matter how you phase those coils, how do you generate three phase? You got any idea?
Yeah, to have one phase in and multiple phases of output is relatively easy to do with a rotary machine. If, for instance, I had slip rings going to a single pole armature, and their armature is rotating, and now I've got three phases of stator windings, I could, on a rotary machine, pretty easily give you three phases of output with one phase of input with that mechanical rotation. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yes, I understand mechanical rotaries and how they work. But I'm doing input signal.
Well, it looks like the motor was not a part of the power conversion, but he had the three coils, and just the electronic circuitry that was properly switching between them.
Have one oscillator and two phase shifting circuits. 120-degree lag and 120-degree lead phase-shifting circuit. So to electronically make one phase in and three phases of output, not too difficult to do with phase-shifting, and separate oscillating coupled circuits. Now, whether or not that really existed, was there electronics on board, or was it just magnetically coupled coils? Your point is that if I have nothing but magnetically coupled coils, you could still do it by using the coils as a 120-degree lag and 120-degree lead circuit, an LC circuit, off of the main phase of input. That's still possible, Paul. I mean, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Well, I have a little difficulty with that, with just coils and a single-phase input. It's going to be very difficult to do that and maintain a load of 40 kW or whatever the hell he had there.
It is not difficult to do this. You can do it either way. Basically, I'm trying to confirm. There's one on the glass table and one that is with very similar that I sent you the video with. And the phase shift was achieved by an inductive coupling internship.
Yeah, let me. I'm working every day these days, John, with a phase shift over. It's an LC balance. LC balance.
Up on the window, I got 20 in my pocket. 30 on my wrist, 50 on my neck to keep it out of here.
might be too steep to see. Has any testing been done? I know that you had people feeding me through the machine. You were able to hear me coming in at 39 WGB, KTR. Okay, when I didn't raise my power, I think you're saying you were not hearing me. Are you not hearing me because of the other signal, or just that my weaker signal is not making that not on tonight? Would you go on to get your phone?
Hard to believe they're generating three phase without some type of switch. switching networks in there. It has to be as far as out. I don't think they can do it with what they had.
Okay, you've refreshed my memory. You can get a phase shift with just inductors and capacitors with no primary, secondary coupling, so to speak. The example I gave of a series inductor and a shunt capacitor and a 25-ohm resistor across them, and the series inductor has got 50 ohms of inductive reactance, the shunt capacitor has got 50 ohms of capacitive reactance, that circuit that I just designed for you is a L pad, an L network. Whatever voltage you put in at that frequency where you get those reactances, you get exactly half the voltage out, and an example I gave, exactly 90 degrees of phase lag. And if you build a second circuit like that where you reverse where the inductor and capacitor are located, it becomes a 90 degrees phase lead with half voltage output. Now you take a pair of those, connect all of the inputs in parallel, but use the outputs in series. And the 25 ohm and 25 ohm resistor becomes a single resistor of 50 ohms. You've now made a complete LC balance where you've got an unbalanced coaxial input of 50 ohms. You'll have a thoroughly balanced 50 ohms of output, completely floating output, so to speak. And that's a very convenient way of feeding a dipole with coax cable and not end up with any current flowing on the outside shield of the cable. Let me drop. Okay. I just gave you plus and minus 90 degrees of phase shift, and each one of those L networks gives you half voltage out, but those two of them being operated at once, half and half outputs are in series, you get unity in and unity out in magnitude, plus or minus 90 degrees, which is really 180 degrees of difference between the two, and you end up with a completely floating output like feeding a dipole, as if you had done it with a one-to-one balancing transformer. Now, that example is plus or minus 90 degrees. With just readjustment of the L's and C's and the R, I could make that plus or minus 120 degrees. I wouldn't get the same magnitude of output, but to make an LC network have 120 degrees of phase lead and another 120 degrees of phase lag, fairly simple to do. So making phase lead and phase lag with fairly passive networks without using any active oscillators and amplifiers can be done, John. At first we talked about doing it with a rotary machine. Now we're doing it with passive LC networks. KC2WGB, does that make some sense? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, and I believe that would work under moderate current. I don't think that would drive a motor. I have difficulty with that because nobody makes a simple, sort of a passive converter. Anything you buy is going to be solid-state switching. There has to be a reason for that. I'm not sure what the reason is, but because we went into single-phase to three-phase conversion in all different ways, they could not make it work without the switching or without rotary machines.
Well, if you and I are running a high-power motor with three phases, there's about three reasons why you use three separate phases made by Con Ed. Number one, with the three phases, you've got a definite, clearly defined direction of rotation. Depending on how you wire the motor, it will turn clockwise, or you wire it another way, it'll turn counterclockwise with no doubt about it. You know exactly what direction it's going to climb, it's going to rotate, because your wiring has generated a thoroughly rotating magnetic field in one direction, as opposed to a so-called split-phase, one-phase motor that you and I use as a washing machine motor. You can start it up clockwise, and it'll keep running clockwise, or you can start it up counterclockwise mechanically, apply the voltage, and it'll keep running counterclockwise. That's only one phase. So with passive, with Con Ed three-phase power, you know exactly what direction it's going to run. You have minimum current on the three wires. They're all drawing the same amount of current, and it's a very efficient machine when it's done correctly. If I wanted to take one single phase and with an LC network run a three-phase motor, it could be done. I will admit that that inductor and that capacitor better be very beefy. And the total amount of current I'm going to draw on that one phase is going to be more than three times higher, and the overall efficiency, if I'm not careful, could be kind of low, and it'll run correctly only at one particular load, that 120 degrees of phase shift that I talked about. In my case, before at 90 degrees, required a very specific load of resistance. Well, you start loading down a rotary machine, and its equivalent resistance goes up and down. So you're not going to get 120 degrees of phase shift anymore. So I could design it to run at one particular load at synchronous RPM or near synchronous RPM. Nobody does it that way because of all of those I think you can see there, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Oh, yes. Now your last description. Oh, I agree with you 100%. But now, think about using the device you just talked about in over unity. My God, with that percentage of efficiency, I don't see how it could be done.
Okay, I accept you now. Now, how do you make any machine have opening? That's another whole very complicated question. Where is the extra energy coming from? If you're above unity, and if for the next 5 hours in a row, you're getting more real kilowatts of output than you're putting in, where is the energy coming from? That's a very complicated question. You could say that's the basis of the investigation that Wesley is doing. I mean, there's some very smart people in Europe who say they are doing it. And they've got pretty good credentials. You can't say they're crazy. You can't say they're wrong until we start getting into the specifics of real, true RMS current and voltage going in, real, true RMS current and voltage coming back out, and hopefully the light bulbs, which are the load, are all being lit up with only I squared R heating, not by way of ionization of the gas inside, which is another source of lighting that could be higher in efficiency, and it could potentially make it look like more watts are coming out than really are. The quickest way I know of to really confirm the output, no matter how the output is happening, is an ultraviolet light in the glowing gas as well as the glowing filament. But when you put the light bulbs into a sealed box, and by calorimetry, measure the thermal energy in the box. If you're putting 1,000 watts of high voltage, I mean high frequency, low frequency, all kinds of things. If I'm really putting 1,000 watts of real energy into a light bulb, and if I put the light bulb into a black box, which is part of a calorimeter, and now I measure the rate at which the temperature of the water in the calorimeter is going up. In other words, I'm converting all of the light, all of the heat, I'm converting everything into thermal energy. And now I quantify that thermal energy. Now I know the real power output. Wonder if you see where I'm going on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB, absolutely, Dick. I agree. If you look at that video carefully, was that he had some even cow rod units hooked up. He had approximately 45 to 55 bulbs. They're different sizes physically, but he had quite a bit of lampage there. Then you have that 40 horsepower motor, which is turning. And if you look at the measurements that he was making with the ammeter, at the motor, it was difficult because the clown kept his hand over the reading. You couldn't see, actually. But it looked like he had, in the heavy leads, which looked like number two wires, I think he was running 50 amperes. He had another set, which I think was going to motor, which was